Are you tired of feeling tired? Do you wish you could turn back the clock on aging? NT-Factor Lipids is the breakthrough supplement that's scientifically proven to repair and renew your body's cells. NT-Factor Lipids are identical to the phospholipids found in your cellular membranes. They've been shown to repair mitochondrial damage, a primary cause of biological aging. In clinical trials, NT-Factor therapy resulted in a 26.8% increase in mitochondrial function, restoring it to levels found in young adults. NT-Factor has also been shown to reduce fatigue by up to 43% and has even been shown to significantly reduce a wide range of symptoms and improve the quality of life in patients with various conditions like chronic fatigue and those undergoing chemotherapy. I've been using NT-Factor for years and prescribe it for my patients. You can find the NT-Factor line of nutritional formulas at your favorite health food store or online retailer. Or, to order direct, call 800-982-9158, 800-982-9158, or go to ntfactor.com. That's ntfactor.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today we're going to focus on cancer detection. And in the past, cancer detection boiled down to get your colonoscopy, get a chest x-ray, get a pap smear, get a mammogram. But there's a whole new frontier of cancer detection. And today we're going to talk to an expert. He's been a frequent contributor here on Intelligent Medicine because our guest, Dr. Gary Goldman, is one of America's foremost integrative women's health experts. He's also a general functional medicine expert, and he has an active practice here in New York City. He is board certified in obstetrics and gynecology, but his interests range way beyond just traditional women's care. He does functional medicine here in New York, and he's interesting in that he has an academic affiliation. He's also an attending at Weill Cornell Medical College, and he has unique expertise on cancer testing because he's very familiar with GRAIL, which is the developer of the Galleri cancer test. He's on the Speakers Bureau for GRAIL. So I saw him in a meeting recently, and I said, Gary, it's time you come back on the program, and let's talk about cancer screening detection, and there's a whole new world of opportunities are opening up, but not without some concerns and reservations. So it's a time of great flux, a time of great opportunity, potentially a time of some peril if we uncritically adopt some of these techniques without further demonstration that they really work. So without further ado, Gary, it's a pleasure having you back on Intelligent Medicine. Thanks very much for joining us. He is a New York colleague, so it's nice to have you with us. You're probably just a few blocks away from me up there in your office on the Upper East Side. I, too, am on the in Midtown, so stone's throw, literally.
Well, Ron, thanks for having me back. It was great to see you at that recent meeting. We had a lot of fun together, and it's great to be back on your show as well.
Indeed. So tell us a little bit about, I think one of the ways to start is to talk about, in particular in relationship to women's cancer concerns, you know, the state of the art. What do we rely upon? And, you know, what are the pros and cons of some of these techniques that we use to screen for cancer?
So I'm going to start with what is the standard of care? And the standard of care is really determined by majority rules. What is everybody doing in the community? And pretty much everybody follows the recommendations from the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, which is a group of physicians who come and go. They consult. It's an illustrious body, but they tend to be extremely conservative. And as such, I invite every one of your listeners to go onto the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force website. It is sobering and frankly frightening. I'm the kind of nerd who on a Saturday actually is looking at that because I can't believe it. And frankly, it's entertaining. So having said that, what is the state of the art of cancer screening in this country? The answer is the same that it's been for the 35 years since I finished residency. No changes whatsoever.
Right.
And that's reiterated by other society guidelines such as the NCCN, the American College of OBGYN, on and on.
And by the way, it also even extends to outside your area of expertise to recommendations about PSA screening. That remains controversial. Yeah. And in fact, they came out with a very controversial recommendation that got all the urologists upset, saying, oh, you know, PSA screening doesn't really save lives, so maybe we should forego PSA screening altogether. Then they kind of, in response to the pushback, they said, well, yeah, maybe with certain reservations, you know, but let's not rely on PSA screening. But they kind of tacked towards the middle on that.
Right. So let's talk about, I'm going to look at this through the lens of the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, because they are the most commonly referenced group. Let's talk about it. So what do women get for preventative cancer screening? They get a pap smear. Even that's controversial, and we can talk more about that. Should we first do pap smears or HPV testing? Both? Neither? At what interval? I mean, that's
and when to stop. Also, when to stop. That's a
exactly.
Other, yeah.
Exactly.
Because I have women coming in to see me who say, you know, they're like 78 years old, and they say, well, I guess I'm due for my annual pap smear,
right,
having had innumerable pap smears that were negative and their HPV negative.
Right.
But they dutifully show up because they think they need it.
Right. And then they're told by their doctor they don't need it anymore. And there's, again, we can talk about that in some detail. Then comes mammograms. That's equally as controversial. When should we start? How often should we do them? When should we stop? How good are they? When should we start thinking about adding sonograms, MRIs, and that is really the beginning of a very interesting discussion. I hope I'll have time for that.
Yep.
Then comes colonoscopy. Similar story there. We can talk about Cologuard. There's a recent study looking at genetics through serum samples.
Yeah, it's a blood test for colon cancer. Yeah,
that's right. And there are pluses and minuses there, as well as things like Cologuard, which is a stool sample. So we can talk about that. But those are the big three. If you're a smoker, you get a chest X-ray. And that's it for women. For men,
or even a CAT scan. So it's thought that, right, maybe that's a, right, like a spiral CT. I'm not even sure what that is, but it's something that's
right,
more looks at the lung tissue more in a more sensitive way than just an ordinary X-ray.
That's, yeah, right. And then for men, yes, colonoscopy. And then PSAs, as you properly pointed out, that got a category C from the U.S. Preventative Services, namely, discuss it individually with your physician. We're backing off on giving a recommendation. There isn't good enough information to say one way or the other.
That's a pretty tepid recommendation.
Right. Yeah. There isn't a urologist or a patient who doesn't want to do the PSA. You know, notably absent, how about skin cancer screening?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And U.S. Preventative Services says no, category D. We don't have anywhere near sufficient data to discuss the risks and benefits. And I'm thinking about all of those risks, like chilly room, benefits like diagnosing skin cancers. I'm trying to weigh that. But this is the nature of the beast.
Or a bill for $400 that I got for a biopsy that turned out to be negative, you know, which my insurance didn't cover. Okay.
I'd call that getting your money's worth.
Right. But, you know, just apropos the skin cancer, I don't want to divert to that because I want to focus on women's health. But it, in fact, you know, in medicine, what we try to do sometimes, we do a lot of things. And then we, at the end of doing them for decades, we do what's called evidence-based medicine. We actually test the hypothesis. Does it really work? Does it really make a difference? And they were kind of hard-pressed to find that skin cancer screening, amazingly, that the studies did not really show that much in the way of benefit. And I it's beyond my level of expertise to critique those studies and say, you know, how they missed the boat, because clearly there are instances where skin cancer screening can prevent people from being, you know, from dying of melanoma.
That's right.
And, you know, skin, ordinary skin cancer probably doesn't kill you, but it can deface you, squamous cell and basal cell. But anyway, so coming back to these traditional means of screening, there, I guess I'm getting the impression, and I've had this impression for a long time, is that they're somewhere short of perfect. So we need better, you know, like we're way ahead in terms of cardiovascular medicine. We can really prognosticate, you know, who's at risk. You know, we have a lot of tests. But in cancer, cancer often strikes people unawares and can kill them.
You know, Ron, so cancer is the second leading cause of death, almost now caught up with cardiovascular disease. So my entire career, I've been saying, where are the cancer screening tools? Where are they? And I've seen any number of pilot studies. Hey, we have a new blood test, a new protein marker in particular, trying to replace, for instance, CA125 as a means of following ovarian cancers. Now, I get a lot of patients coming in asking for a CA125 blood test. Mm-hmm. And everybody, American College of OBGYN, American Cancer Society, says it's not a cancer screening test.
Yeah.
And it isn't. There's a 50% false negative rate for stage one ovarian cancer.
So in other words, to put it, we'll talk about, you know, false positive and false negatives, because that's an important concept I think the public doesn't really understand. But what in its essence you're saying is that you could have a negative CA125 and still have ovarian cancer.
That's right. It's a flip point.
Conversely, it's possible you could have a CA125 that's out of range, that's elevated, and not have ovarian cancer.
Right. Those are called false positives
or false negatives.
Mm-hmm. Everything. Right. So the positive test with somebody who doesn't have a cancer is the majority, not the exception. So Everything causes elevations of CA125, fibroids, endometriosis, peritonitis,
smoking. I think
that big one there is for CEA, right?
Oh, which okay.
is, yeah. So it's a useless test. Even stage four ovarian still has 20% negative rate. Mm. So it's used in oncology to follow therapy.
Right.
So if somebody had an elevation mm-hmm. and then the elevation goes down with therapy and then that number comes back up again, that's recurrent cancer. And that's the only thing it's been shown to be useful for.
And similarly with prostate cancer, the PSA is a really good test. If you've had prostate cancer, you want to get that PSA down to near zero. And then you were followed, you know, at intervals of 6 months or a year by your urologist or your primary care. And you want to see if that PSA is creeping up, because that's a sign of recurrence, and that may create the need for additional therapy. So that's the use case, the well-documented and relatively uncontroversial use case, but using those tests for screening falls short. So let's put those tests on the shelf, and we'll come back to some of these tests and their limitations in a while. But I want to focus on your work with Galleri, because wouldn't it be nice if there was a universal blood test for cancer and you could go in part of your annual physical, get a blood test to tell you whether you have cancer or not, that a test that's reliable, that's sensitive enough to pick up cancer at a stage early enough where it's going to make a difference, because a test that's going to pick up cancer where it's, you know, metastasized to every organ in your body is a relatively useless test, because stage four cancer is very hard to treat. We don't really have ways of generally saving lives when people have advanced cancer, but we can if someone has, say, early breast cancer, early colon cancer, or something along those lines.
That's right. That's right. So that's where Galleri comes in. This group started after there was an article published in the JAMA back in 2015. Pregnant women were beginning to be screened with non-invasive prenatal testing.
So that's a fascinating story. Yeah, you tell that story.
So rather than using protein markers like the quad screen or AFP, mm-hmm. et cetera, to look for Down syndrome in the newborn, we started looking at genetics. It turns out some fetal DNA or fragments of fetal DNA cross the placenta and can be found in the maternal circulation. The technology at that point had advanced to the point where they could now identify not just that it was of fetal origin, but also to quantify the chromosomes.
Wow.
So you would see a little fragment of chromosome 1, another fragment of chromosome 9, and on and on. And then suddenly there's a preponderance, 1.5 times instead of one, a singleton, of, say, chromosome 21. Voila, you've diagnosed Down syndrome.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, the state of the art prior to that was you had to take a fetal biopsy or something?
No. So the non-invasive testing was called first AFP, and it ultimately became quad screen, 4 different protein markers.
Was there ever a time where you actually had to retrieve some DNA from the placenta or something like that?
Yes. So
that was in the dark ages, right?
No. And that was still at the same time frame, and it's still utilized today.
Okay.
So two options there, amniocentesis and chorionic villus sampling.
Oh, great. Okay.
Those both get fetal tissue, either placental tissue or amniotic fluid, and look at fetal cells directly. But those are considered the gold standard, and they can diagnose a whole slew of issues. But
it's kind of invasive.
It is invasive, and there are risks, including loss of the pregnancy.
Yeah.
So people need a good reason to do it. And up until that time, the big dividing line was, quote, advanced maternal age, age 35 and older. And the silliest reasons why that came about, that particular age. Suffice it to say, people didn't typically start with amnio and CVS in general, but individually, yes, some still did that also, rather than relying on these fuzzy protein markers, because they were far from perfect.
Anyway, so the new technology like PCR amplification, that's very... magnify these tiny amounts of circulating proteins, infinitesimal amounts, and there's all this volume of blood in your body, and it's maybe a very few molecules of these things, they can detect that.
That's right. And as I said, the amazing thing is that the technology had developed to the point where it was able to identify fetal versus maternal cells. Mm-hmm. At any rate, moving forward, the study that was published in JAMA was there were 10 cases where there were very abnormal signals, and yet the babies were perfectly fine. Hmm. It wasn't clearly coming from fetal origin. Hmm. So they started looking very closely at these women. All of them had cancer.
Oh.
And that was the first clue that cell-free DNA, fragments of DNA shed by cells that had died and released their constituents into the plasma, could be utilized in identifying cancers with a simple non-invasive blood draw.
Could this also be termed a liquid biopsy?
Yes, that's a common term used for
it. So in other words, you don't have to go extract the cancer or stick a needle in the cancer. The cancer is shedding some molecular signature or some fragments into the bloodstream, which can then be identified through really high-tech methods, even though they're infinitesimal. And then that gives you an indication that a cancer is present. But sometimes doesn't tell you where it is.
So interestingly, if we can talk a little bit about epigenetics.
Sure.
So, when those first two cells combine, the sperm and the egg, they create a single new cell that has a full complement of genetics. And then, of course, that single cell divides into two identical cells, into 4, into 8, and on and on. Eventually, that original blob starts to differentiate, and some of it becomes heart, and some of it becomes brain, pancreas, liver, you name it. And of course, when I was in medical school, they couldn't explain that. They said, well, some kind of miracle happens.
Yeah.
And it turns out that is epigenetic differentiation, basically turning off a series of genes and turning on others specific to the organ in question.
So each cell is what's called pluripotent. It has all the genetic information to create an entire new body, but it is expressed, turned on, and turned off by this epigenetic process.
Exactly. That's called cellular differentiation.
Okay.
It's a very important part of keeping us healthy. When people de-differentiate, that's an easy way to get cancers. And David Sinclair writes very thoughtfully about that being a primary cause of aging. is the dedifferentiation. So the epigenetic determination, turning on and turning off genes, is vital in differentiating organs and also in creating cancers. So when we're looking at these epigenetic patterns, which are patterns of methylation, methylation is a way of turning on and turning off different genes. It turns out that that pattern is replicable throughout the cancer kingdom. Maybe okay. Not every cancer.
So there's like a library of methylation changes that speak to the presence of cancer, in other words.
That's right. And using machine learning, they took the 3 billion base pairs that form our DNA, and they identified the 1 million that are most important in differentiating via methylation into cancers. So they developed this pattern of these 1 million sites, because to the cost of looking at 3 billion is astronomical. We're able to knock it down to 1 million sites. Just a million? Right. And find a replicable pattern that was consistent with cancers. Not one particular type of cancers, but cancers across the board.
So a human being look at all these possibilities, their eyes would glaze over. They would have to, you know, hire, you know, a 500,000 people, or, you know, a person would have to live 10,000 years to figure this out. So machine learning, AI, it accelerates the ability to understand these associations.
Exactly. So interestingly, that same tool of looking at methylation patterns can very clearly tell us what is the cell of origin that's yielding this cancer. In other words, where did it come from? Which organ did it come from? And the number that has been shown both in lab studies and clinical studies is about 89% accuracy in identifying the organ of origin. So when somebody gets back an abnormal test on Galleri, it says a cancer signal has been detected, and it's coming from head and neck. Mm-hmm. Now, neck is, or stomach, or wherever it might be coming from.
Okay.
Head and neck is a big area.
Yeah.
So, you know, those people have to be fully evaluated. Right. First thing we're going to do is send them to the ear, nose, and throat doc. They're going to do imaging studies. Right. They're going to do endoscopies. They're going to look for these abnormal masses. Right.
But at least it's not like a blind man's buff, you know, where you have no idea where it is. You can somewhat localize it with some degree of accuracy.
Right. I mean, you know, again, 89% right from the get-go is pretty darn good in my book.
Yep. So let's now talk a little bit about something called Bayes' theorem for mathematics and how it applies to screening and sensitivity. I see you smiling, your eyes light up because you understand this concept, but I think we have to help lay people understand this because there's a kind of a counterintuitive thing that happens when a test is 90% sensitive or even 95% sensitive. It's going to pick up things, you know, 9 out of 10 times or 19 out of 20 times. But if you just apply it to people who are very unlikely to have whatever it is that you're looking for, the value of a positive test goes down. It can, so for example, in breast cancer screening of very healthy young women with no family history of cancer, I understand that the probability of a woman having cancer, if she has a positive, so what is read as a positive mammogram, is as low as the teens. It might be 15%. So
that's right.
Explain that paradox for our lay audience. It's a challenge, but.
Right. So when we're looking at statistics, and this is where everybody's eyes glaze over, we're looking at these studies in terms of their sensitivity and specificity, as well as their positive and negative predictive values.
Okay.
So in a low-risk population, I'm going to dumb this down, a low-risk population, the positive and negative predictive values are lost. And that's exactly what you were referencing. But the sensitivity and specificity are maintained.
Okay.
So what does that mean? It means that at the end of the day, we should be looking at people at high risk for cancers.
Okay.
And that's exactly what GRAIL has recommended when utilizing this test. So for instance, it was only tested in people 22 and older. So if you send in a study on a 19-year-old, it's rejected. There is no information on its utility in that low-risk population. But obviously, we understand that it's not going to be fantastic because the incidence of finding a cancer in that population is so, so small. But there are many risk factors. So if you look at the biggest risk factors for developing cancer, number one is age. The curve of when people develop a cancer really starts to rise rapidly, right? That's the first derivative. It's going up very quickly, beginning around age 50. And then it peaks and comes down around age 79. Not that you're home free after that point, but you're lower risk again. So from 50 to 79 is when most cancers are going to be found. So that age group is certainly one of the groups of people we are zeroing in on. If you look up on National Institute of Health or any of the major cancer websites, you can pick out a dozen or so high-risk factors that determine when, who else is at an increased risk of developing cancer.
Obviously, so, smoking, occupational exposure, things like that.
Smoking.
Obesity, perhaps, even.
Yes, obesity. But things that people don't think about is sedentary lifestyle. Lifestyle high in processed foods. Right, for every 10% increase in processed foods in your diet, you increase your risks of cancer by 14%. And the average American diet is 60+% processed food. It's mind blowing. So our diet is incredibly important. At any rate, so there's this multitude of risk factors, and that's where we have to be zeroing in. When we're determining who should utilize this test.
So another way that I explain this sometimes to patients who want, you know, every test under the sun, you know, they say, test me for anything, test me for HIV, you know, all this kind of thing. I sometimes say to them, well, here's an example. The HIV test is very, very reliable, but more reliable than the Galleri test, right? It's like 99%, 99.9% accurate. But what if you were to test a population of, nuns in a convent who are very low risk for HIV, I presume. You know, I mean, they may have a checkered past and, you know, joined the order, but presumably low risk. You actually have almost a greater chance of coming up with a false positive than coming up with a true positive in such a population. So this is an example of how, you know, statistics can be funny around this.
Right. That's a great example.
Yeah. So, so this test now is being deployed in some doctor's offices. Do you do the test? Do you offer the test? Okay. And so it's available. It's FDA approved.
It's not FDA approved.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So how is it then? How can you make available something that's not FDA approved? It's investigational. Is that what it is?
Nope. So lab-derived tests do not have to be approved by the FDA. Remember, it's Food and Drug Administration, and lab tests are neither.
I see.
It is CLIA certified.
Right.
So that's the laboratory certification, and it's certified.
Now, and I kind of like that because, you know, some of the tests that we offer as integrative and functional physicians are not mainstream tests. They're innovative. They're cutting edge. They're the tests of the future in many cases. And I like that they're available. And this would be one of them.
You know, if you look closely at your labs that I'm sure you're sending off daily on your patients, I'll bet you at least 20% of them have a paragraph written after the value that says, this is not FDA approved. It's developed by XYZ Corporation. And so we're used to using.
I think it might be, you know, oxidative LDL or something like that.
You know, something. How about a CA-125?
Even a CA-125, such a mainstream test.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Because there was never a need to be FDA approved.
Okay.
Now, GRAIL has been working together with the FDA. This is this is tough because this is the first genetic cancer screening test ever derived. Mm-hmm. So they want it to be FDA approved. Why? Mm-hmm. Because once it's FDA approved, it's likely the federal government will pick it up from Medicare right. and Medicaid.
Because and now it's cash on the barrel head, basically. It's not covered exactly. by insurances and Medicare and Medicaid. Yeah.
Exactly. Once it's covered by the federal government insurers, then commercial insurers typically follow suit.
Okay, Gary, I want you to pause and hold on to that stream of thought because we divide our podcast into two parts. And in part two, I want to talk a little bit about what some of the controversy is around the Galleri test, because there are those who say that it's not ready for prime time, although there is a big trial underway as part of the National Health Service in the UK. And that trial is now subject to some degree of controversy. We'll talk a little bit about what underlies the controversy. We'll talk a little bit more about some of the other ways that we can test for proclivity to cancer, because there's a whole new technology about genetic screening for cancer. You've heard of the BRCA test, BRCA1 and 2, and you can go on and on and on in terms of iterations of tests that measure cancer susceptibility. That's a different ballgame than these liquid biopsy type tests. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and when we return, more on the subject of cancer screening. This is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.